I'd like to look at four judges this evening: Othniel, Ehud, Shamgar, and Deborah. We pick up the story in Judges chapter 3, verse 7. And we find there that the people of Israel had once again departed from God and worshipped the local Canaanite gods, and in punishment Jehovah had sent upon them a man of unpronounceable name here, who comes from Mesopotamia, and he oppressed the people of Israel for 8 years. He was eventually driven out by Othniel. The fact that he comes from Mesopotamia indicates that the invasion came from the north, because just about the only way you could effect a conquest of Canaan if you came from Mesopotamia was to travel via the so-called Fertile Crescent and then descended upon Canaan from the north. The fact that the invasion came from the north and was driven out by someone from the south, Othniel came from the tribe of Judah, indicates that the conquest on this occasion must have extended over pretty well the whole of that Canaanite territory, that is, that territory between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea. And so Othniel becomes a national hero. Well, it's there in verses 7 to 11. The only point I'd like to make about this is the good example it gives us of how the faith of an older person can reap fruit in the lives of the younger ones who follow his example. Because you'll remember that Caleb was a man of well over 80 years of age, and he had proved that his faith of 40 odd years previously still stood firm when he drove out the fierce people who lived in Hebron. And so he said, in effect, "Okay, all you young chaps, I've set the example. I've driven out these people from Hebron. Now there are other towns that are still occupied by these people, and whoever drives them out, I'll give them certain rewards." And we find then that Othniel drove out the people of one particular town, and he received Caleb's daughter as his wife. A very good lesson there for us, whether we be young or old. Here is a man who took the challenge, who was spurred on by the faith of an older one, and who eventually became a hero in his own nation. So much for that first deliverer. The second one we meet in verse 12, and it follows through almost to the end of the chapter. And on this occasion, the people of Israel are oppressed by the people of Moab in verse 12, helped in verse 13 by the people of Ammon and the Amalekites. Moab and Ammon were brother nations who bordered Israel on the east, and they had consistently needled away at those eastern tribes of Israel. But on this occasion you find that not only the eastern tribes fell under their power, but also some of the tribes west of the river here, or certain portions of them anyway. And it was for 18 years that Moab exercised this rule over those parts of Israel, and the king of Moab was this man Eglon. Huge man, very fat person. He is eventually killed in a rather colourful narrative that we have here. If you look at verse 13, you find that Eglon gathers to himself the Ammonites and the Amalekites, and he went and defeated Israel, and they took possession of the city of Palms. So it tells us then that they had not only taken control of these eastern tribes, but they had crossed the Jordan River and come to the city of Jericho and taken control there. Now Jericho was situated somewhere around the region of that border between the tribal portions of Benjamin and Ephraim. So that was the area into which they had come. And in verse 15, they are to be driven out, the enemy are to be driven out, by a man called Ehud, who was a Benjaminite. So notice again how it all fits together here, that the deliverer comes from that very area where they had fallen under the rule of Eglon, king of Moab. Well, I think you may be familiar with the story, and if you aren't, well, then maybe you could read it for a sort of bedtime lullaby, a sort of story to soothe you to sleep. They had to pay, that is, the Israelites had to pay a tribute, that is, a lump of money, to Eglon, king of Moab, every year. Now, Ehud was one of the leaders of the tribe of Benjamin, and you find that what he did, on this particular occasion anyway, was to go over to Moab, pay the cash, and then come back to Israel. However, that was a ploy, you might say, to make all the people of Moab think that everything was okay. But actually, Ehud was organizing rebellion. It worked something like this, that he had arranged for people in his own tribal area of Benjamin to prepare to attack the Moabite occupation forces, that is, the Moabite forces who had come across the river and were occupying certain areas of Ephraim and Benjamin on the west bank of Jordan. So Ehud then went out from there down through the city of Jericho, the city of palms. Then he went through the city of Gilgal. Remember that Gilgal was the place where the Israelites in the time of Joshua had set up 12 stones as a memorial of the miraculous crossing of the Jordan River, and they were engraved with suitable words commemorating the event. So he went down past these sculptured stones at Gilgal, down further across the Jordan River, and then through the Eastern Territories tribe over to Moab, paid the cash, came back, crossed the river, got as far as Gilgal, just to make everybody think that the mission was now complete. But then he sent his fellow Israelites further on into Israel to organize the rebellion, while he turned back and by himself came to Eglon, the second time now. He managed to bluff his way through, talked to the muscle men at the door, and told him he wanted a private audience with the king. And they fell for the trick. So they let Ehud in to see Eglon. They shut the doors, and while the guardsmen were lolling around playing draughts or something outside, Ehud killed Eglon. He then made his escape by a secret route that he had worked out, and he got back right into Israelite territory before the rather dull guardsmen had woken up to the fact that all was not well. Why was it that this man was taking so long? And of course, when they opened the doors and eventually got inside, they found that their king was dead. But the damage had been done, because by now Ehud had come back across the river, through Gilgal, past the sculptured stones, through the city of Palms, Jericho, and he had organized his men. And now they launched their attack on the Moabite occupation forces. So there was utter confusion. West of the river, the Moabites were attacked by the Israelites. East of the river, the king had been assassinated, and so there was confusion there, and the Israelites now took full advantage of the situation, so they won a great victory. Now you can imagine that what would happen was that the Moabite forces would flee and try to get down across the Jordan River and back into their home territory again. But you could only cross the Jordan River, in those days anyway, at three or four places along its entire length. And so what the Israelites did was resort to a very old trick. They stood at the crossing of the river and they just picked off the Moabites as they came to try to get away. Well, it's all there in chapter 3. In fact, we might read just a few verses which pick out the details towards the end. Verse 26. Ehud escaped while they delayed, that is, while these dumb guardsmen at the palace delayed, wondering what was happening. Ehud had made his escape, and he had passed back across the Jordan River and beyond the sculptured stones at Gilgal, and he escaped into his own territory. Verse 27, when he arrived, he sounded the trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim. Notice again, Ephraim, the hill country of Ephraim, along with his own country of Benjamin. And the people of Israel went down with him from the hill country, having him at their head. And he said to them, "Follow after me, for the Lord has given your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand." So they went down after him and seized the fords of the Jordan against the Moabites, and allowed not a man to pass over. And so it goes on showing how they killed the people and won a great victory. Verse 30, so Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest for 80 years. That brings us now to the third of the people I'd like to mention here, and that was Shamgar in verse 31. All we know of Shamgar here is that he won a victory over some Philistines and killed 600 of them. The Philistines occupied the area on the southern coastal plain of Palestine, down the south there of that area of Judah. At this particular time, the Philistines had not really caused a great amount of trouble to Israel. The time of the Philistine domination of Israel is yet to come. It'll develop later on in Judges, and then through the books of Samuel you'll find it referred to. But this was one of the earlier attempts by the Philistines to exercise a greater rule over Israel, and on this occasion they were beaten by Shamgar. But just from those three stories, notice the three entirely different areas with which the stories are concerned. The first one, coming from the north, moving through to the south. The other one, coming from the east, across the Jordan, then into that little area there just west of Jordan. And now this third one, down here on the southern Palestine coastal plain. However, I'd like to spend most of my time tonight on the fourth of these judges, and that is Deborah, and that's referred to in chapters 4 and 5. And before we start looking at the story, if we look at the map, we'll just get an indication as to the areas with which this story is concerned. It is concerned with the northern part of Israel. Notice up there on the coast you have the tribe of Asher, it will be referred to. You have the tribe of Naphtali and the tribe of Zebulun, all of them in the north. The town from which the Canaanites exercised their rule was Hazor, which was just north of the Sea of Galilee. It had been burnt by Joshua when he carried out his conquest, but the local people had regained possession, had rebuilt the town, and now they took revenge upon the unfortunate Israelites. You'll find the battle is to be fought at a place called Mount Tabor, now just south of the Sea of Galilee there, in that territory around Zebulun and Issachar, is Mount Tabor, and it is on the northern fringe of the Plain of Esdraelon. The Plain of Esdraelon was one of the very few flat areas in Palestine where people could have a good battle. And that is why you find so many of the battles referred to in the Bible are fought around this Plain of Esdraelon, with Megiddo, one of the important towns on the edge of the plain, Mount Tabor to the north, and the Kishon River, which flows across the plain just beside Mount Carmel there. Now these are some of the names that you'll meet as you go through the story, and you'll find how they're all congregated around that northern area. The woman who delivers them is Deborah, and she comes from the central part of Israel. I think we'll begin to read and then we'll pick up the rest as we move on. Chapter 4, verse 2. And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. And the commander of his army was Sisera, and you'll meet this man, Sisera, in a very colourful story as it moves along. Verse 3, the people of Israel cried to the Lord for help, because Sisera had 900 chariots of iron. Now once again you see how he operated on the plain country, the plain lands. The Israelites were confined to the hill country, and so he oppressed the people of Israel cruelly for 20 years. Now Deborah was a prophetess. She was judging Israel at that time. That is, she was exercising some sort of administrative control in Israel. People came to her to settle disputes, and I think it was because she was a prophetess that she was so effective in the work that she did. A prophetess was a person who had some insight into the mind of God. And because she had this insight into the mind of God, she was able to give sensible judgments in the cases that were brought before her for a decision. She exercised her administration from a place between Ramah and Bethel, in verse 5, between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. So you see there she was fairly well in the center of the country. But when this great crisis arose, she moved up north to direct events in the rebellion against Jabin, king of Hazor. Verse 6, she summoned this man Barak to go with her. And Barak, in verse 6, we are told, is from the tribe of Naphtali, which again fits the picture as we've outlined, set in the north country. Barak, we'll recall, was something of a coward. He would only go if Deborah went with him. It wasn't to his credit, of course, but nevertheless, a great victory was won. And this is what Deborah says in verse 6. She says, "The Lord, the God of Israel, commands you, go gather your men at Mount Tabor, taking 10,000 from the tribe of Naphtali and the tribe of Zebulun." So they're taken from the tribal people of Israel who are in the area of Sisera's control. And the plan was to make Sisera think that there was some sort of rebellion organized in Israel. He was to take all these people up into Mount Tabor so that the Canaanite people who controlled the plains below would think that a rebellion had broken out. This would then draw out the chariot forces of Sisera. And what was going to happen was that God would send a great thunderstorm. Now, as I said, Deborah was a prophetess, and I would again think that she had insight into what was going to happen. But nevertheless, it required faith. I'm not sure that anybody else knew what was going to happen. What they were required to do was to obey the instructions which were given to them. So under the direction of Deborah and Barak, the Israelites assemble their force up on Mount Tabor. Sisera falls right into a trap. He brings all his chariot forces out across the Kishon River into the small plain which led up towards Mount Tabor. Then this enormous storm built up. It broke. There was, you might say, a cloud burst. The ground was turned into a quagmire. The gentle stream of Kishon became a raging river. The Israelites then swept down upon the forces of Sisera. The chariots became bogged in the slushy ground, the horses went crazy, the storm was upon them, and Sisera's forces were in total disarray. And very soon you find then that the Israelites come down, even though they didn't have any sophisticated weaponry, with what they did have, their sharpened sticks, nulla nullas, or whatever they had, they were able to take advantage of the situation, and so they won a great victory. It's a very good example of how faith combines with action. And I think it's for this reason that you find Barak is referred to in Hebrews 11 as one of the great men of faith. This is a balance that we all have to maintain. We have to plan, we have to think ahead, but on the other hand, we have also to trust completely in God. And sometimes we're so well organized that there's no room for trust in God. Then you get the other people who don't organize or think about anything and think that God is going to bail them out at the last minute every time. Here we have an example of the combination of complete trust in God, obedience to his commands, but yet at the same time carefully planning what they were doing. Because the entire victory depended upon obedience to what God had said and trust that God would send that cloud burst right at the moment that would result in the victory for Israel. Well, you can read the story through and you find that Sisera escaped. When you come to verse 17, he fled and came to the tent of a man called Heber. And Heber was a person that was on the side of Sisera. The only thing wrong was that Heber was not home when Sisera called. And instead of meeting Heber, Sisera met Jael, Heber's wife. And Jael happened to be on the side of Israel. But Sisera didn't know this. He was dog-tired after fighting all day and having a long flight from his pursuers. And Jael, showing hospitality to him, said, "Why don't you go to sleep, have a rest?" And she gave him some milk to soothe him. The next thing you know, he was sound asleep. And then while he was sound asleep, Jael came and drove a tent peg through his head. You find it all referred to there, all the gory details, in verses 17 through to 22. Verse 21, there it is. Jael, the wife of Heber, took a tent peg, took a hammer in her hand, went softly to him, and drove the peg into his temple till it went down into the ground as he was lying fast asleep from weariness. And so he died, which is hardly surprising. Then Barak, as he pursued Sisera, he came and Jael met him, and she said, "Come and I will show you the man whom you are seeking." And what a sight met his eyes. And so he went into a tent, and there lay Sisera dead, with a tent peg in his temple. The Israelite forces then rallied round, and that day they won a great victory. And so verse 24 concludes the story by saying that the hand of the people of Israel bore harder and harder on Jabin the king of Canaan until they destroyed Jabin king of Canaan and regained their independence. Well, there you have some of the details. Now the remainder of the details are given in chapter 5, which is the song of victory which Deborah and Barak sang to celebrate this conquest. Verse 2, that the leaders took the lead in Israel, that the people offered themselves willingly, bless the Lord. I remember many years ago hearing Mr. Howley preach a magnificent address based on this verse, or using this verse as an illustration of what he was saying. When you get strong, positive leadership, you'll get a good, strong, positive following. Now this morning we saw some of the dangers when people blindly follow a leader without having any conviction themselves. Now that is true, but that still does not justify a lack of leadership. And one of the things we need in our churches is strong leadership. Not leadership from people sitting in ivory towers throwing around commandments, but people who will lead by example. When there is a strong leadership, you'll get a strong following. And here were leaders who led by example, and they enthused the people, and the people went with them and offered themselves willingly. And so a great victory was won. You come to verses 4 and 5, and you find reference to the tremendous storm that day. Second half of verse 4, the heavens dropped water, the earth trembled, thunder and lightning and rain. Verse 5, the mountains quaked before the Lord. Verses 6 to 9 are an aside showing just how bad things were in those days. The raiding Canaanites had made trade, travel, farming almost impossible. Verse 6, in the days of Shamgar and in the days of Jael, caravans ceased and travellers kept to the byways. It wasn't safe to travel on the main roads because the Canaanite people with their chariot forces controlled things. The Israelites had to go by back routes because they couldn't even defend themselves, seeing they had no weaponry. Verse 7, farming we find ceased in Israel because of the raids of these people. You'll find this spoken of again in the story which follows concerning Gideon. Verse 8, new gods were chosen, it says, when war was in the gates, was shield or spear to be seen among 40,000 in Israel? Were there any weapons in Israel? No, because the Canaanites had prevented the Israelites from making weapons. But then arose Deborah as a mother in Israel, and without weapons they won this great victory. Verse 9, my heart goes out to the commanders of Israel who offered themselves willingly among the people. There again, leadership of people offering themselves, doing work, getting into it, and showing the people by example what was required of them. And so in verse 10, tell of it, you who ride on tawny asses, all the toffs, all the rich people who sit on rich carpets, and you who walk by the way, the man in the street, as we would say, rich or poor or Mr. Average, all of you, he says, to the sound of musicians at the watering places, there they repeat the triumphs of the Lord, the triumphs of his peasantry in Israel. This bunch of farmers, these people oppressed by the oppressor, yet they won a great triumph. It moves on then in the following verses to show how the people of the different tribes offered themselves willingly for the battle. Verse 13, then down marched the remnant of the noble. The people of the Lord marched down for him against the mighty. From Ephraim they came in verse 14. From Benjamin they came. From Machir, which was one of the main clans of Manasseh, they came. From Zebulun they came. Verse 15, from Issachar, and so it goes on, they came and presented themselves. But not all came. There were some people who rather would have stayed at home and looked after themselves. I'm okay, why should I worry about others? And so among the clans of Reuben there was great searching of heart, because in verse 16 we find that they tarried among the sheepfolds to hear the piping of the flocks. Well might there be among the clans of Reuben great searchings of heart, because they looked after their own interests instead of coming to the aid of their distressed brethren. Not only Reuben, but verse 17, Gilead stayed beyond the Jordan. Gilead was Gad, the tribe of Gad, there beyond the Jordan, over the other side, on the eastern side of the Jordan River. They stayed home too. And Dan, he stayed there by the ships. There is Dan, you see, on the Mediterranean coast. And Asher sat still at the coast of the sea, settling down by his landings. You have Asher in the north on the coastal plain there in the northern part of Palestine. These four tribes, Reuben, Gad, Asher and Dan, exhibiting that selfishness which is the curse of any community where people are not concerned for the plight of others. And here you have it again. Why should I disturb myself to go and help those who are in need? And so people are looking after themselves without any care for those who are in distress. And so they get God's condemnation, and justly so. And so do we, if all we're concerned about is ourselves and our own comfort, and we have no concern for those who are in need. By contrast, in verse 18, Zebulun jeoparded their lives, and Naphtali too. Zebulun and Naphtali had very good reason to jeopard their lives, because they are in the very area that Jabin and Sisera controlled. Then verse 19 onwards tells us how these kings came and fought, these kings of Canaan, that is, Jabin and Sisera and all their hosts. They came, they fought. They fought at Taanach by the waters of Megiddo, but they got no spoils of silver. They thought this would be another one of those battles when they could come and loot and get all the booty for themselves. But on this occasion they lost the battle, and so they got no spoils of silver, because in verse 20, from heaven fought the stars. From their courses they fought against Sisera. The cloudburst, you see. The torrent Kishon swept them away. The onrushing torrent, the torrent Kishon swept them away. And so there was this chaos, and chariots upturned and chariots bogged, and horses galloping and horses charging. Verse 22, the loud beat of the horse's hoofs with the galloping, galloping of his steeds. Israel won a great victory. But a special place is reserved for Jael towards the end of the song, because Jael, you remember, got rid of Sisera. And so in verse 24 through to verse 27, she is praised in very lavish terms. We won't read it because it really repeats many of the details that are given in the narrative section of chapter 4. But the point I'd like to make is to contrast the selflessness of Jael with the selfishness of Reuben, Gad, Asher and Dan. Here was a woman who risked her life to save her people. we may not justify all the terminology which the Israelites use in composing this victory song. They certainly seem to have almost, you might say, a wicked delight as they think of how Sisera was dispatched. But then it was a victory song after all, and people do rather get carried away sometimes. Verses 28 to 30 give us a picture of Sisera's mother waiting for her hero's son to return. And you can imagine the Israelites really enjoying their taste of victory as they paint this picture of the mother of Sisera waiting for her son to return. And of course they know that Sisera will never return. And so in verse 28, out of the window she peered, the mother of Sisera gazed through the lattice, and she says, "Why is his chariot so long in coming? Why tarry the hoofbeats of his chariots? It's only Israel he's fighting. I thought he would have been home long ago." But her wisest ladies make answer. Yes, in fact, she answers for herself. And this is what they say in verse 30. "Are they not dividing the spoil?" That's what they're doing. There's so much spoil, there's so much booty, that it's taken them a long time to divide it all up. And not only that, but there's a maiden or two for every man. These are victorious soldiers, and they've got one-track minds. And so not only do they want the dyed stuffs and the embroidered stuffs and all the riches, but they also want a few girls for themselves as well. And so they paint this picture of the mother of Sisera looking out of the window, longing for her son. And they know as they write this song that the son lies dead. I'm not suggesting for one minute that that poem there at the end of this song of victory is in any way a pattern for Christians to follow. We know that we are not to rejoice over the downfall of our enemies. But I don't believe the song is put there as a pattern for Christians to follow. It's put there as part of the song of victory which the Israelites sang when they saw the overthrow of their oppressors. And these oppressors were among those people whom God had said had to be exterminated. So it's to be read, I believe, simply as part of the overall picture of the conquest which Israel gained over its enemies. But I wonder if they crowed too soon. Because very soon you find that the people had departed from God again, and they were back under the control of other oppressors. "Let him who thinks he stand take heed lest he fall."